Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham, it's Friday, March 17th, 2017. Welcome to the Madness. A happy St. Patrick's Day. Why not grab a pint for this edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast? Thanks for clicking play. I'm Jeff Tiberi. On this edition of the podcast, we are joined by a longtime political reporter, a former ABC News reporter, a longtime NPR correspondent and contributor. His mother calls him Ken. You perhaps know him best as the political junkie. Ken Rudin on the line. How are you, sir?
I love the fact that my mom got our early billing in this podcast. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. Very much appreciated.
We need much more than a pint, and not because it's St. Patrick's Day.
Are you wearing green?
I am. Well, I will be wearing green, but I'm feeling kind of blue lately, if you want to know the truth.
Why are you feeling blue?
Well, you know something, look, we know what we got when Donald Trump was elected. He promised a lot of things and he's delivered on a lot of things, but there are other things that are beyond reality, are just becoming surreal. And, you know, the wiretap bugging, the wiretapping of alleged wiretapping of President Obama probably leads the list. If you listen to Thursday's news conference, White House news conference, news briefing with Sean Spicer, why do I listen to that? I don't know, but I listened to the whole thing, and I basically looked for the liquor cabinet once it was over.
We're in a new era of at least national politics, or an unprecedented chapter is maybe a little bit more narrow of a way to look at it. We're going to get to some of the happenings, the musings that are taking place in Washington this week. I want to start and just jump into it, a deeper philosophical question. Hopefully our listeners are not rolling their eyes. I want to ask, you've been covering politics literally longer than I've been alive, not to make you feel old, but totally
you
to
know,
make you feel old.
That McKinley assassination was awful.
What's at the heart of politics? There's power, money, sex, there's actual policy. But based on your 30-plus years covering politics, what are the first few things that come to mind, basic things that are really at the heart of all politics, whether we're talking about a Trump administration or a Reagan administration or local or state politics? What is this all about?
Well, you know, so that's a great question, and it's one I've never gotten in all my centuries of covering politics. And I think it comes down to, and this sounds very trite, but it comes down to people and it comes down to history. And I think that for the most part, and for overwhelmingly the most part, there is a desire out there to make things better. The way our lives are conducted, the way our lives are, we're living our lives. I think these people go into politics to make things better. I mean, there, of course, as you point out, there are some who line their pockets. There are some who are sent to jail for that very reason. But I think ultimately they get into it to make things better, and I think they believe in it. And for the most part, I believe in it too. And if I don't feel especially optimistic at the present, and when I mean the present, I don't mean 2017. I mean any time I would have been asked this question. You know, I started at ABC News in 1983. Was I optimistic in 1983? Maybe not. But I think what I also love about it is that there's a history involved. There's a history and there's a lore and there's the thought of the great people who came before now, and perhaps the great people who will come again. So I think every time I get down in the dumps and think, my goodness, the dishonesty, the bullying, the lying, the contempt some politicians have for the rest of the country, I remember people who came before, and I think of people who might come afterwards, and I keep that optimism.
I was chatting with a former Washington strategist recently, and I'll give you the names that he gave to me after we get your answer. He said to me, these two men were the most effective legislators, lawmakers that he had ever seen. And he was on Capitol Hill going back to the mid-70s. So I'm wondering from you, and I'll tell you the two names he gave me in a moment or two, but who was the most effective legislator, whether Republican or Democrat, one of each, one from each chamber, however you want to handle it. But when you think of people that, I guess more concisely put, what lawmakers understood the apparatus and were able to utilize the rules and the gamesmanship of the Senate and the House better than anyone else? That's not concise at all, but I think you know what I'm trying to spit out.
I do, and that's a tough question too, because, I mean, you know, you think of people who obviously have history, and you know, right now, very often people rise to power much quicker than they ever did before. You know, the thought of Barack Obama, running for the Senate in 2004, get elected, and then the president 4 years later. Whereas Joe Biden, I think, was elected for the first elected to the Senate in 1066, and you know, he was down there forever. So sometimes I think you don't have the history and the recollection that you have had in the old days. Obviously, a name that jumps to mind, and of course, this is a little bit before my time, but the thought of Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson twisting arms, able to win votes. I think he understood what members wanted. I think he understood what appealed to members, and he also understood what Republicans needed as well. So I kind of think, when I think of, if I think of somebody in each chamber, or at least in each party, I would think of a Lyndon Johnson. Maybe I would even think of a Edward Dirksen and what he did in the 1960s to get his Republican conference to go along with the Lyndon Johnson Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. The Republicans were not in power in the 60s. As a matter of fact, the Republicans went decades without power from 54 to 94 because of Democratic rule. But you still have to pull members of your own party alongside. So I think of Everett Dirksen, I think of Lyndon Johnson, I think of those people who understood the system, knew what worked, how to appeal to members, and to get things done.
For whatever it's worth, the person that I had a conversation with recently said that the two men who best understood, he said the two people, but they were both men, who best understood the U.S. Senate were Jesse Helms, former North Carolina senator, and Ted Kennedy, former U.S. senator from Massachusetts.
Well, that's a great, a fascinating choice. I would certainly agree with Ted Kennedy. And what's interesting about Ted Kennedy is that for the longest time, he was seen as a dilettante. I mean, of course, we know about his early drinking and Chappaquiddick and the womanizing and all that. And I think, and then of course he ran for president in 1980, and he was asked why he wanted to run and why he wanted to be president, and he didn't give a coherent answer. But once he realized he was not going to be president, once he realized that he was an adult in the room, he became clearly one of the great legislators of our time. And I agree with that on the list. Jesse Helms, I don't know. I think, well, of course, a lot of my problem is how he dealt with race. And there were always questions about racial components to his reactions and how he felt about things. Not because he was a conservative, because there are some great conservatives. You think of Robert Taft, for example, in the 1940s and early 50s. So, I mean, it's not because he was a conservative. I don't know if he was warmly loved, shall we say, by anybody in the Senate. But I think he knew the system, and even though he came from not politics, but from broadcasting, but he just knew he certainly knew his constituents. He knew how to win. It's an interesting choice. I'm not sure if I had more time to get to think of this, I would even have Helms on my top 10 list. But it's a fascinating list.
Okay. One thing we do like to do regularly here on the Politics Podcast is throw people on the spot. And that is what I've done with that question. And that's what I'll do with this question as well, which is, what's one story or interview that you have not done over your time covering politics, something you didn't get to, somebody you weren't able to track down?
Oh, boy. And that's a great question, too. You know something? I think of these things. Let me just tell you one interview I did have that I really, really appreciated. And I'll go to my grave thinking how wonderful it was. And it was with Ted Kennedy. And if you remember, I mean, whatever you think of Ted Kennedy as a legislator, as a debater, as somebody who knew the Senate well, one-on-one, on camera, he was not a great interview. He stammered. He had difficulty completing a sentence, which is hard to imagine. I mean, you think of his as a great orator, but one-on-one, he was not a great interview. And I remember sitting with him in his office. Oh, I'm not sure what year this was, it could have been 1989, 1990, something like that. And basically he just couldn't get through the interview. And so I said, you know what, let's stop the interview. Let's stop the camera and let's stop and then just chat. And he was amazing. He talked about his passions. He talked about, you know, injustices in the world. He talked about his family, and he showed me pictures of his nieces and members of his family. And so I really appreciate that, because I think there are great people out there that may not always be understood by people who, you know, the folks who watch TV or follow Congress or follow politics. But I think given a chance to treat them as human beings and not as just a person who's involved in a political issue, I think the greatness of them comes out even more so.
Ken Rudin, a.k.a. The Political Junkie, is your guest on the WUNC Politics podcast this week. Ken, let's chat about some of the current events happening in Washington. The American Health Care Act, I believe that's what it's called, the American Health Care Act, we've got these proposals to supersede and undo and replace Obamacare, this, that, or the other. I don't mean to oversimplify it. It strikes me that bill in present form is dead on arrival, probably won't make it through the House, no way it's going to make it through the Senate. What are your thoughts on this issue at this point?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I think you're absolutely right. Did I say the word "I think" and you're absolutely right in the same sentence?
Thank you,
Ken. I love
the
English language. But I think you're right about that. I mean, I think that even Paul Ryan acknowledges that, look, even if it gets past the House, it has a very tough going in the Senate. And that's why there are two bodies, and that's why amendments are made and changes are made. What strikes me the most interesting about this is that, you know, from its inception, from 2010, when the Democrats passed it without a Republican vote, Republicans and Tea Party conservatives and everybody like that vowed to repeal it. I mean, I think they sent a measure to the House 83 times that John Boehner would roll his eyes and yet allow it to come up to vote, saying we repeal Obamacare. And of course, when you had a guy named Obama in the White House, it was not going to be repealed. But now that they have complete power, they have the White House, they have both chambers of Congress, you think that they would already have this thing ready to go, and they don't. And it's interesting, you know, it's interesting the other day that President Trump said, you know, it's pretty difficult coming up with health care legislation. And I think the official word out of Washington was duh, as opposed to, in other words, sure, it's difficult. And that's why it was difficult for Obama to get the Democrats through. You think of how they pushed it through in 2009 and 2010 and what Nancy Pelosi had to do to twist arms and get people to vote for it. And maybe it cost a lot of Democrats their seats in 2010. But the fact is that the Republicans came into power in 2017 not on the same page. And so while clearly the goal of the Republicans is to repeal and replace, a lot of conservatives, many conservatives, feel that it's still keeping too much of Obamacare, you know, the original Affordable Care Act, in place. They feel that it's not getting rid of Medicaid fast enough, or at least the Medicaid expansion fast enough. It's not; it's giving too many tax credits to the poor. But Paul Ryan knows, and I guess John Boehner knew this beforehand, that if you acquiesce to all the conservative demands, you turn off the moderates in the party, let alone the Democrats, whose votes you probably may need to get to pass it, given the fact that there are a handful, or at least more than a handful, of Republicans who are going to vote no. So it's a balancing act for Paul Ryan. You don't want to give everything to the right and then have the moderates say, wait a second, this is too draconian for me. So Ryan has a tough, he's the ultimate optimist. He smiles during interviews. He really, you know, listens to all the questions, knows he has a tough road ahead of him. The question is, you know, where does he give and where does he take? And of course, it's still a work in progress. He insists that President Trump is getting involved in the negotiations. If that's true, this would be the first test of Trump working with Congress instead of talking at Congress. So again, we have a ways to go before it's passed. But I think, you know, Ryan is certainly trying his best.
certainly one of the most pivotal, biggest moments in his political career, Paul Ryan, that is. We think he continues to have aspirations to run for the White House again at some point. I mean, he was on the ticket several years back in 12. I want to ask you about gridlock. So as a millennial, I don't have a great historical, a personal historical recollection of Congress and gridlock. And it feels like there's, you know, a lot of attention paid to, oh, gridlock at Washington, in Washington is an all-time high. I think if you were to look at the House of Representatives, there's always been some diversity, right? Going back 235, 240 years. But now you've got an even more diverse nation. I wonder about whether gridlock is in fact greater and if that has anything to do with the diversity and the complexities of our nation, or if gridlock has always been gridlock and perhaps it's just getting more plain attention.
Well, we always say that gridlock is at its all-time worst, and I think it is. And everybody points fingers when it began. Some people point fingers to maybe 1987 when the Democrats blocked Robert Bork as Ronald Reagan's choice for the Supreme Court. People say, well, no, it's really when the Republicans went after Jim Wright, the Speaker of the House, in 1989. And then the Republicans will say, well, what about the Democrats when they blocked John Tower as Secretary of Defense, in, you know, also in 1989? And so it's always a tit for tat. I think the ultimate, it certainly got worse under George W. Bush, and it got even worse with Bill Clinton. Both under Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, the opposite party blocked tons of court nominees. They just stonewalled the nominees. They never got to a hearing. Think of Jeff Sessions, who was defeated in the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1986 when he wanted to move up to become a U.S. attorney, a judge. So in other words, both sides played the game. I think it really got to the ultimate with Barack Obama. Not only was so much legislation bottled up, we always remember the famous quote by Mitch McConnell that my goal is to make Obama a one-term president. But even the perfect example is Merrick Garland, the Supreme Court nominee that not only didn't get a vote in 2016, but he didn't even get a hearing, Obama's choice to succeed Antonin Scalia as a Supreme Court justice. And not only did he not get a vote or a hearing, but the Republicans didn't pay a political price for it. So everybody says they hate gridlock and they hate when they do that. But obviously, if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it. The opposition party, wouldn't do it. They certainly did it in 2016, or at least in most of the 8 years of Barack Obama, culminating in the Merrick Garland non-vote. Here's the thing, and you know, we haven't seen this since, I guess, Obama in his first 2 years of his administration, in his first term. You have unified government, unified by the same party, I should say. So the thought of gridlock is kind of like it shouldn't happen if the Republicans in the House and the Senate and the White House are all coming from the same party. Let's see what happens. Let's see if that's a good thing. And of course, if they pass whatever they want, and of course if the Democrats feel steamrolled over, and if a majority of the country, which did not vote for Donald Trump, feel that they're being ignored, we'll see a reaction in perhaps 2018, perhaps 2020. But all the talk about gridlock, and we saw it under Obama presidency and a Republican Congress, it should not be the same when you have a unified, so-called unified government in 2017.
So-called being the two key words there. Ken, you are a trivia aficionado, not only politics, but baseball. I'm going to attempt to stump you here and preface this with, if I ask you a question that, in fact, you have the right answer to and I don't have the right answer to, I'm going to look like an idiot on the podcast. But, hey, you know, you roll the dice sometimes.
Hey, look, when you have your own podcast, you can't look like an idiot, because that's why God created editors.
Right. Who was the first former American professional athlete to then be elected to Congress? I feel like this is a good one. I had a chance to stump you. Humble brag.
The first
person to be elected to Congress who had been a former professional athlete here in the United States.
Well, I don't know if I could tell you who the first one was. I could tell you a big one in North Carolina, and that was Wilmer Vinegar Ben Mizell, who was a great baseball pitcher, and he was elected to Congress as a Republican from North Carolina, I think, in 66.
68, and I'm only telling, I do not know that off the top of my head, but I'm looking at it. But yes, Wilmer was elected to Congress in 68 from the 5th Congressional District, served from 69 to 75. I'm actually looking for somebody, I'll give you a couple hints here, who's a couple of decades earlier won a seat in the House and did not play baseball, played what is now America's pastime.
Wow, so it's not. I know Walter Johnson ran for Congress from Maryland in the 1930s, but I think he was defeated. I think, and I do know that Whizzer White, Kennedy's appointment to the Supreme Court, was a great college football star, but of course he didn't play professional football.
Walter Johnson would have been the answer if he had won the seat, Maryland's 6th Congressional District in 40, but he lost.
Right.
So I can give you a team if that would.
Okay.
The team is. I'll do this. I won't even say the team name. We'll see if this helps you. It's a team that is community owned. Does that help you or no? It's a football team that is community owned.
Are the Packers or Vikings community owned?
The Packers are.
So is it a Packer? Oh, gee, I don't. So the answer is the Green Bay Packers. That's the player we're looking for?
It is, yeah. It was a player from the Packers from 27 to 34, and I'll keep hinting at clues here. Oh. And we can always cut this out. If I don't want to make you feel bad not knowing a trivia question.
No, no. But first of all,
so
I mean, 1927, I was only a teenager then, so I can't. I don't think I know the answer to this.
U.S. House of Representatives from Wisconsin's 8th District from 43 to 45. So just one term, it appears.
I don't know.
A man by the name of Laverne Dilweg.
I don't know him. I know Laverne Dilweg. I have a button of Laverne Dilweg along with Shirley Chisholm. Have you ever seen that button?
I have not seen that button. You have an incredible collection of political buttons, like several
You've never
thousand,
seen
right?
That Laverne and Shirley button.
Oh, geez. All right, got me. Fine. You got me.
I don't know. I did not know that, and I do like that. But I do like that we got a chance to talk about Wilmer Mizell.
Yes, absolutely. So anyway, there's a little trivia. I will bestow upon you a WNC mug or something like that for playing along and being a good sport.
You should see what my mug looks like right now. I'm so disappointed I didn't know the answer.
Longtime political reporter Ken Rudin, also known as the Political Junkie. You hear him regularly on The State of Things. You heard him for many years on Talk of the Nation on NPR. You have undoubtedly learned something from Ken during these many radio appearances. Hopefully you took something away from today's podcast as well. Ken, thank you so much.
Jeff, it was absolutely my pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's all for this edition of the WUNC Politics Podcast. Share the episode on Twitter or Facebook, subscribe to the program on iTunes, Google Play, and or Stitcher, and remember to find all the latest political stories at our website, WUNC.org. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Go enjoy some basketball.
I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes.